quite so.
And in all these cases, the recollection may be derived from things either like or unlike.
It may be.
And when the recollection is derived from like things, then another consideration is sure to arise, which is, whether the likeness in any degree falls short or not of that which is recollected.
Very true.
And shall we proceed a step further, and affirm that there is such a thing as equality, not of one piece of wood or stone with another, but that, over and above this, there is absolute equality, shall we say so?
Say so, yes, and swear to it with all the confidence in life.
And do we know the nature of this absolute essence?
To be sure.
And whence did we obtain our knowledge? Did we not see equalities of material things, such as pieces of wood and stones, and gather from them the idea of an equality which is different from them? For you will acknowledge that there is a difference, or look at the matter in another way. Do not the same pieces of wood or stone appear at one time equal, and at another time unequal?
That is certain.
But are ill equals ever unequal, or is the idea of equality the same as of inequality?
Impossible, Socrates.
Then these, so-called, equals are not the same with the idea of equality.
I should say, clearly not, Socrates.
And yet from these equals, although differing from the idea of equality, you conceived and attained that idea?
Very true.
Which might be like, or might be unlike them?
Yes.
But that makes no difference. Whenever from seeing one thing you conceived another, whether like or unlike, there must surely have been an act of recollection.
Very true.
But what would you say of equal portions of wood and stone, or other material equals? And what is the impression produced by them? Are they equals in the same sense in which absolute equality is equal, or do they fall short of this perfect equality in a measure?
Yes, in a very great measure too.
And must we not allow that when I or anyone, looking at any object, observes that the thing which he sees aims at being some other thing, but falls short of, and cannot be, that other thing, but is inferior, he who makes this observation must have had a previous knowledge of that to which the other, although similar, was inferior.
Certainly.
And has not this been our own case in the matter of equals, and of absolute equality?
Precisely.
Then we must have known equality previously to the time when we first saw the material equals, and reflected that all these apparent equals strive to attain absolute equality, but fall short of it.
Very true.
And we recognize also that this absolute equality has only been known, and can only be known, through the medium of sight or touch, or of some other of the senses, which are all alike in this respect.
Yes, Socrates, as far as the argument is concerned, one of them is the same as the other.
From the senses then is derived the knowledge that all sensible things aim at an absolute equality of which they fall short.
Yes.
Then before we began to see or hear, or perceive in any way, we must have had a knowledge of absolute equality, or we could not have referred to that standard the equals which are derived from the senses, for to that they all aspire, and of that they fall short.
No other inference can be drawn from the previous statements.
And did we not see and hear, and have the use of our other senses, as soon as we were born?
Certainly.
Then we must have acquired the knowledge of equality at some previous time.
Yes.
That is to say, before we were born, I suppose.
True.
And if we acquired this knowledge before we were born, and were born having the use of it, then we also knew, before we were born, and at the instant of birth, not only the equal or the greater or the less, but all other ideas, for we are not speaking only of equality, but of beauty, goodness, justice, holiness, and of all which we stamp with the name of essence in the dialectical process, both when we ask and when we answer questions. Of all this, we may certainly affirm that we acquired the knowledge before birth.
We may.
But if, after having acquired, we have not forgotten what in each case we acquired, then we must always have come into life having knowledge, and shall always continue to know, as long as life lasts. For knowing is the acquiring and retaining knowledge, and not forgetting is not forgetting, Simmias, just the losing of knowledge.
Quite true, Socrates.
But if the knowledge which we acquired before birth was lost by us at birth, and if afterwards by the use of the senses we recovered what we previously knew, will not the process which we call learning be a recovering of the knowledge which is natural to us, and may not this be rightly termed recollection?
Very true.
So much is clear, that when we perceive something, either by the help of sight, or hearing, or some other sense, from that perception we are able to obtain a notion of some other thing like, or unlike which is associated with it, but has been forgotten. Whence, As I was saying, one of two alternatives follows. Either we had this knowledge at birth, and continued to know through life, or, after birth, those who are said to learn only remember, and learning is simply recollection.
Yes, that is quite true, Socrates.
And which alternative, Simmias, do you prefer? Had we the knowledge at our birth, or did we recollect the things which we knew previously to our birth?
I cannot decide at the moment.
At any rate, you can decide whether he who has knowledge will or will not be able to render an account of his knowledge. What do you say?
Certainly, he will.
But do you think that every man is able to give an account of these very matters about which we are speaking?
Would that they could, Socrates, but I rather fear that tomorrow, at this time, there will no longer be anyone alive who is able to give an account of them such as ought to be given.
Then you are not of opinion, Simmias, that all men know these things?
Certainly not.
They are in process of recollecting that which they learned before?
Certainly.
But when did our souls acquire this knowledge? Not since we were born as men?
Certainly not.
And therefore, previously?
Yes.
Then, Simmias, our souls must also have existed without bodies, before they were in the form of man, and must have had intelligence.
Unless indeed you suppose, Socrates, that these notions are given us at the very moment of birth, for this is the only time which remains.
Yes, my friend, but if so, when do we lose them? For they are not in us when we are born, that is admitted. Do we lose them at the moment of receiving them, or if not, at what other time?
No, Socrates, I perceive that I was unconsciously talking nonsense.
Then may we not say, Simmias, that if, as we are always repeating, there is an absolute beauty, and goodness, and an absolute essence of all things, and if to this, which is now discovered to have existed in our former state, we refer all our sensations, it with this compare them, finding these ideas to be pre-existent and are in possession, then our souls must have had a prior existence, but if not, there would be no force in the argument. There is the same proof that these ideas must have existed before we were born, as that our souls existed before we were born, and if not the ideas, then not the souls.
Yes, Socrates, I am convinced that there is precisely the same necessity for the one as for the other, and the argument retreats successfully to the position that the existence of the soul before birth cannot be separated from the existence of the essence of which you speak, for there is nothing which to my mind is so patent as that beauty, goodness, and the other notions of which you were just now speaking have a most real and absolute existence, and I am satisfied with the proof.
Well, but is Sebes equally satisfied? For I must convince him too.
I think, said Simmias, that Cebes is satisfied, although he is the most incredulous of mortals. Yet I believe that he is sufficiently convinced of the existence of the soul before birth, but that after death the soul will continue to exist is not yet proven even to my own satisfaction. I cannot get rid of the feeling of the many to which Cebes was referring, the feeling that when the man dies the soul will be dispersed, and that this may be the extinction of her. For admitting that she may have been born elsewhere, and framed out of other elements, and was in existence before entering the human body, why after having entered in and gone out again may she not herself be destroyed and come to an end?
Very true, Simmias. About half of what was required has been proven, to wit, that our souls existed before we were born, that the soul will exist after death as well as before birth is the other half, of which the proof is still wanting, and has to be supplied. When that is given, the demonstration will be complete.
But that proof, Simmias and Cebes, has been already given. If you put the two arguments together, I mean this and the former one, in which we admitted that everything living is born of the dead, for if the soul exists before birth, and in coming to life, and being born can be born only from death and dying, must she not after death continue to exist? Since she has to be born again, the proof which you desire has been already furnished. Still, I suspect that you and Simmias would be glad to probe the argument further, like children. You are haunted with the fear that when the soul leaves the body, the wind may really blow her away and scatter her, especially if a man should happen to die in a great storm, and not when the sky is calm.
Cebes answered with a smile.
Then, Socrates, you must argue us out of our fears. And yet, strictly speaking, they are not our fears, but there is a child within us to whom death is a sort of hobgoblin. Him too we must persuade not to be afraid, when he is alone in the dark.
Let the voice of the charmer be applied daily until you have charmed away the fear.
And where shall we find a good charmer of our fears, Socrates, when you are gone?
Hellas, is a large place, Sebes, and has many good men, and there are barbarous races not a few. Seek for him among them all, far and wide, sparing neither pains nor money, for there is no better way of spending your money, and you must seek among yourselves too, for you will not find others better able to make the search.
The search shall certainly be made. And now, if you please, let us return to the point of the argument at which we digressed.
By all means, what else should I please?
Very good.
Must we not ask ourselves what that is which, as we imagine, is liable to be scattered, and about which we fear, and what again is that about which we have no fear, and then we may proceed further to inquire whether that which suffers dispersion is or is not of the nature of soul, our hopes and fears, as to our own souls will turn upon the answers to these questions.
Very true.
Now the compound or composite may be supposed to be naturally capable, as of being compounded, so also of being dissolved, but that which is uncompounded, and that only, must be, if anything is, indissoluble.
Yes, I should imagine so.
And the uncompounded may be assumed to be the same and unchanging, whereas the compound is always changing, and never the same.
I agree.
Then now let us return to the previous discussion. Is that idea or essence, which in the dialectical process we define as essence or true existence, whether essence of equality, beauty, or anything else, are these essences, I say, liable at times to some degree of change, or are they each of them always what they are, having the same simple self-existent and unchanging forms, not admitting of variation at all, or in any way, or at any time?
They must be always the same, Socrates.
And what would you say of the many beautiful, whether men or horses or garments, or any other things which are named by the same names, and may be called equal or beautiful, are they all unchanging, and the same always, or quite the reverse? May they not rather be described as almost always changing, and hardly ever the same, either with themselves, or with one another?
The latter. They are always in a state of change.
And these you can touch and see, and perceive with the senses, but the unchanging things you can only perceive with the mind. They are invisible, and are not seen.
That is very true.
Well then, let us suppose that there are two sorts of existences, one seen, the other unseen.
Let us suppose them.
The seen is the changing, and the unseen is the unchanging.
That may be also supposed.
And, further, is not one part of us body, another part soul?
To be sure.
And to which class is the body more alike and akin?
Clearly to the seen. No one can doubt that.
And is the soul seen or not seen?
Not by man, Socrates.
And what we mean by seen and not seen is that which is or is not visible to the eye of man?
Yes, to the eye of man.
And is the soul seen or not seen?
Not seen.
Unseen then?
Yes.
Then the soul is more like to the unseen, and the body to the seen.
That follows necessarily, Socrates.
And were we not saying long ago that the soul, when using the body as an instrument of perception, that is to say, when using the sense of sight or hearing or smell other sense, for the meaning of perceiving through the body, is perceiving through the senses, were we not saying that the soul too is then dragged by the body into the region of the changeable, and wanders and is confused, the world spins round her, and she is like a drunkard, when she touches change?
Very true.
But when returning into herself she reflects, then she passes into the other world, the region of purity, and eternity, and immortality, and unchangeableness, which are her kindred, and with them she ever lives. When she is by herself, and is not let or hindered, then she ceases from her erring ways, and being in communion with the unchanging is unchanging, and this state of the soul is called wisdom.
That is well and truly said, Socrates.
And to which class is the soul more nearly alike and akin, as far as may be inferred from this argument, as well as from the preceding one?
I think, Socrates, that, in the opinion of everyone who follows the argument, the soul will be infinitely more like the unchangeable. Even the most stupid person will not deny that.
And the body is more like the changing.
Yes.
Yet once more consider the matter in another light. When the soul and the body are united, then nature orders the soul to rule and govern, and the body to obey and serve. Now which of these two functions is akin to the divine, and which to the mortal? Does not the divine appear to you to be that which naturally orders and rules, and the mortal to be that which is subject and servant?
True.
And which does the soul resemble?
The soul resembles the divine, and the body the mortal, there can be no doubt of that, Socrates.
Then reflect, Sibs, of all which has been said, is not this the conclusion, that the soul is in the very likeness of the divine, and immortal, and intellectual, and uniform, and indissoluble, and unchangeable, and that the body is in the very likeness of the human, and mortal, and unintellectual, and multiform, and dissoluble, and changeable? Can this, my dear Sibs, be denied?
It cannot.
But if it be true, then is not the body liable to speedy dissolution, and is not the soul almost or altogether indissoluble?
Certainly.
And you further observe, that after a man is dead, the body, or visible part of him, which is lying in the visible world, and is called a corpse, and would naturally be dissolved and decomposed and dissipated, is not dissolved or decomposed at once, but may remain for some time, nay even for a long time, if the constitution be sound at the time of death, and the season of the year favorable, for the body when shrunk and embalmed, as the manner is in Egypt, may remain almost entire through infinite ages, and even in decay, there are still some portions, such as the bones and ligaments, which are practically indestructible. You agree?
Yes.
And is it likely that the soul, which is invisible, in passing to the place of the true Hades, which like her is invisible, and pure, and noble, and on her way to the good and wise God, whither, if God will, my soul is also soon to go, that the soul, I repeat, if this be her nature and origin, will be blown away, and destroyed immediately on quitting the body, as the many say, that can never be, my dear Simmias and Sibs, the truth rather is, that the soul which is pure at departing, and draws after her no bodily taint, having never voluntarily during life, had connection with the body, which she is ever avoiding, herself gathered into herself, and making such abstraction her perpetual study, which means that she has been a true disciple of philosophy, and therefore has in fact been always engaged in the practice of dying, for is not philosophy the study of death?
Certainly.
That soul, I say, herself invisible, departs to the invisible world, to the divine and immortal and rational, thither arriving, she is secure of bliss, and is released from the error and folly of men, their fears and wild passions and all other human ills, and forever dwells, as they say of the initiated, in company with the God's One. Is not this true, Sibs?
Yes, beyond a doubt.
But the soul which has been polluted, and is impure at the time of her departure, and is the companion and servant of the body always, and is in love with and fascinated by the body, and by the desires and pleasures of the body, until she is led to believe that the truth only exists in a bodily form, which a man may touch and see and taste, and use for the purposes of his lusts, the soul, I mean, accustomed to hate and fear and avoid the intellectual principle, which to the bodily eye is dark and invisible, and can be attained only by philosophy. Do you suppose that such a soul will depart pure and unalloyed?
Impossible.
She is held fast by the corporeal, which the continual association and constant care of the body have wrought into her nature.
Very true.